Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Nathan Hobson, and I'm a host for New Books in Japanese Studies, a member of the New Books Network. Today, I'll be talking with Adam Cabot about his book, The River Imp and the Stinky Jewel and Other Tales, Monster Comics from Edo, Japan, which is out from Columbia University Press in 2023. This is an in-depth introduction to the rich and ribald world of kibyoshi. This is a short-lived subgenre of books combining text and illustration on the same page, much like comic books and manga today. Cabot's book presents a selection of five kibyoshi from 1778 to 1807, in which monsters play central roles. Each of these short books is reproduced in its entirety, accompanied by Cabot's translations and commentary. The selection of tales communicates the entertainment value and the thematic variety of these stories, as well as their deep web of interconnections with contemporary culture and the urban economy. The book will be of interest not only to scholars of pre-modern history and literature, but also to a larger sort of general audience, including the growing ranks of manga and anime fans. Okay, Dr. Cabot, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. So I wanted to start off by asking you about how you became interested in the stories, and particularly the visual stories that have become this research project, and I can see some of them in the background where you're recording. So I know this is also something that's personally meaningful to you as well as academically. And I'd love to hear more about that.
First of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about my book. This project began in the 1990s when I was teaching at Musashi University in Tokyo. At that time, I was researching modern Japanese literature, specifically the writer Izumi Kyoka, who is famous for his stories of fantastic. And in 1931, Kyoka published a story about the mythical creature known as a kappa, the river imp that's in the title of my book. Akutagawa Ryunosuke, another famous writer, also wrote a story about kappa that was published 4 years earlier in 1927. And this got me thinking about whether there were other works of modern literature that dealt with kappa, and I was actually able to find enough stories to teach an entire seminar on the subject, which I think tells you something about just how embedded kappa are in the Japanese mind. Anyway, while I was preparing for this course, I read whatever I could find about kappa in folklore studies. There's a lot out there, but traditional folklore, such as Yanagita Kunio, were focusing almost entirely on oral legend. This is when I started wondering whether or not kappa ever appeared as characters in literary works, but predating the modern era. And ultimately, this led me to a genre of popular literature from the Edo period known as kibyoshi. And kibyoshi, which means literally yellow covers, were published in Edo between 1775 and 1806 and use a comic book style with pictures and text on each page. The typical work is only 20 or 30 pages long, and the books are published using monochrome hand block printing techniques. So they were cheap and readily available, widely read books. And what I discovered was that many of these kibyoshi were about monsters, what we call today yokai, but which were usually referred to in the Edo period as bakemono. Yokai has become a term that's used a lot in English nowadays, but I personally don't want to use it because it wasn't a term that was actually used in the works that I'm discussing. And bakemono is not a term that's actually widely known in English. So for this talk and in my own research, I've using the word monster, which is not a completely apt translation, but I think is better than using this misleading term in Japanese here. Anyway, so my original intent was simply to read these kibyoshi as a better way to get to understand about how monsters in general and specifically how kappa evolved in modern Japanese literature. But the more I looked into kibyoshi, the more I realized how fascinating they were. And this is specifically in reference to these monster-themed kibyoshi, how little they had been researched. So while I continue to teach courses in modern Japanese literature, Musashi, my own field of specialization began moving more and more into the pre-modern era. My first step with this new project was to collect copies of the original kibyoshi. Nowadays, you can access a huge amount of Edo period texts online, but back in the 1990s, you actually had to make it the trip to a library and then collect the materials there. And I can remember a funny incident. This was the very first time I visited the old books room at the National Diet Library in Tokyo, which is a very small room on an upper floor of the library. And the day I went there, there were just about three or four old men poring over what looked like really obscure books. So it took me some courage to actually enter the room. And then, well, I worked up my courage. I went inside and I asked the librarian if I could see a copy of what I translate my book as Monsters to the Rescue. And that's when she took out this very secret, I want to say. It was a handwritten catalog going back dozens of years. And she was poring through it. And then she found the book. And I had to wait about 30 minutes or so for her to actually get the book for me. And at the time, I couldn't read the cursive script, which is quite a bit different from the written symbols used in modern Japanese. But I could see the pictures. I was immediately attracted by these weird looking monsters. And as I'm going through the book, looking at the illustrations, I'm thinking, well, what is this story about? What are they saying? What are they doing? And the images were so startling and strange to me that I actually started laughing out loud. Well, not a big laugh, but a kind of laugh. And I was starting to get some strange looks from the old men in the room. So I was starting to feel a little awkward, but I was really wrapped up in these images I was looking at. And I remember looking at that image of the Rokurokubi, or the long-necked monster, for the first time. And she's tied up to a tree with her own neck. And what's going on here? And next scene, there's blood spurting out from the neck, and she seems to have been slashed or something. So I really had absolutely no idea what was going on, but I wanted to know what was going on. So my curiosity was aroused. And that's one of the reasons I made the effort to study the cursive script that was necessary to read the story. I mean, as anyone who does Japanese studies knows, it's a long, hard process to get to the point where you can read things and feel comfortable. And so after many years, oh no, I have to start all over again with something new here. So I was hesitant, but I have to say, if it wasn't for the images that I was encountering, I might not have actually done this. So I think this was a very important part of what got me interested in this research. And in retrospect, I think this actually may be one of the ways these books were read in the Edo period. In other words, that the reader would look at the pictures first, go through the pictures, imagine what the story might be, and then read the text. Or perhaps we have the text read to them, depending on, how literate they were. This was something I used to do in my classes, where I would give the students a text which had no readily available Japanese version to it, and just have them look at the images and say, well, what story is this? And then they would come up with all sorts of interesting interpretations. And then I would like have them read the actual text, and so they could see how far they were, where they were right and where they were wrong. And in any case, it's sort of a way to get you inside the text. So I think that especially it's especially true of these monster themed kibyoushi that I'm studying. The images serve as sort of guides to lead the reader into the actual stories. So to get back to the initial stages of my research, for a few years I was busy collecting these kibyoushi and making microfilm copies of them. If there was no microfilm available, I had to request a microfilm to be made and then have a copy made from that. And at the same time, I was learning how to read these texts and to transcribe them into the modern Japanese. And I was also annotating the stories. And that's when I realized how referential these monster stories were. And that if you really wanted to understand what was going on, you just didn't need to know you need to know a lot more about monsters than just monsters. You also need to know about the allusions of classical literature, to Japanese theater, to the social mores of the time. So I found myself in this whole new world that involved a lot more than I thought it did. And so eventually I started doing less and less of modern Japanese literature, more and more of Edo literature and basically Edo culture as a whole. We're going back now to 1999. After a number of years of doing this research, I published my first book in Japanese, which was a collection of five of these monster stories. This was followed by a sequel that was published in 2000. At that time, I thought, well, I should turn these books into something in English. But I think because I was living in Japan and it just seemed somehow easier to continue publishing in Japanese, it didn't happen at that point in time. And it really wasn't until 2018 that I finally started working on this book. But the basis for the book was already established with the books I had published in 1999 and 2000. On the other hand, I just couldn't take those books in Japanese and turn them to English. I really had to reimagine the whole project and what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it for an English-speaking audience. The upside to this long gap between my first book in Japanese and the English book is that I know a lot more now than I did then. So I actually think it's a better version of what I did 25 years ago. So if to sum this up, I started out researching modern Japanese literature. My obsession with kappa and Japanese monsters in general led me to search for the literary roots, and then this led me to Edo popular literature from the 18th century. And then the books I wrote in Japanese on the subject ultimately became the basis for this book in English. So I started out as a student of modern Japanese literature, and I never imagined I would end up specializing in pre-modern Japan. And well, I guess it's monsters. I have to thank for that.
That's fascinating, and it's I think reading the book in preparation for talking to you, it was quite clear that it was the project of a much sort of longer lifetime really of research, and I was also sort of fascinated to hear you now talk about that transition from sort of modern to pre-modern. I kind of went the other way in part because of the difficulty of reading the scripts. I did a master's degree that was much more about pre-modern Japan. And ended up very much in modern Japan. I think many of us can admire the work that it takes to sort of make that transition, especially once you already have your career begun. But glad you did it. And you're bringing us in this book five stories, originally published, as you said, sort of around the turn of the 19th century, 1778 to 1807. And you draw attention to a number of themes and tropes, some of which you've already begun to reference in your introduction, and I appreciate that. They characterize the kibyoushi genre, also the gokan genre, which is part of what you're doing here. And one of them is the intertextuality, right? All these references to these allusions to things that folks at the time would have recognized. And the sort of playfulness of that, right? Also, and the parody and the symbiosis between the tales and events of the time, the advertising and commerce of the time, and sort of how these are these really interesting crystallized cultural objects. you talk about what you call the use of sophisticated and interconnected media, which I think really sums it up nicely, that reference and parody everything from secular to religious classics to sideshow attractions. And you talk a little bit about what that says about the values, the education, and again, that playfulness that characterized their audience, which is essentially the sort of bourgeoisie of the time, especially in Edo. And you talk about this in your introduction, and I wonder if you could lay out a little bit more of that for our audience here as we get started.
Yes, this whole question about sophistication, intertextuality, how much the readers did know or don't know are really important to understanding and thinking about these works. But I sort of want to get to that question a little bit later on and when we start talking about the individual works. Before I
Sounds
get
great.
there, I want to talk about what exactly are these kibyoushi and the other similar genres that I deal with in the book. And how I decided to structure the book itself, which is very, I think, important in, as to how I actually saw these works or felt that they should be dealt with in academic study. Well, first to get to the literary genres, which is a bit confusing, but here goes. Kusazoshi is a general term which can be translated as something like trifling books, and it's used to talk about this popular genre of graphic literature that was published in the city of Edo. That's an important fact, that it was published in Edo rather than in Osaka or Kyoto. And from roughly the late 17th century into the early Meiji period. So this content, the style of kusazoshi went through major changes over the years and can be divided into five subgenres based on the time of publication. The earliest kusazoshi are called akabon or red books, and these are more like children's picture books than comics. They have simple illustrations and very little text. And akabon reached a popularity around 1716 to 1736, and they were followed by what we call kurobon or black books and albon or green books, sometimes translated as blue books. These were published around the same period, between 1744 and 1774, and they're far more complex and text-oriented than the preceding akabon. And following these books, we have the kibyoushi genre. This is what I'm mo mostly focused on in my book. This started in 1775, and kibyoushi are considered, while an extension of the previous genre, is something sort of unique unto itself, because they, rather than being oriented for young audience or for children, these books became even more adult-oriented to their predecessors. One of the big differences is that the kibyoushi stories are often set in the Yoshiwara pleasure quarters, and they parody not just literary works, but the social mores of the time or conventions of the time. So these anyway, the kibyoushi was started in 1775, only lasted 30 some odd years. And in 1807, we have the new Gokan genre, which you mentioned earlier. Gokan are very complicated and dramatic sagas. There's a lot of backstabbing and revenge going on in these stories. And up until this point, the typical kibyoshi or some of the earlier kusazoshi were in page length, 20 pages, 30 pages, very short. But these Gokan could go on for literally hundreds of pages. Some of them go on for thousands of pages. So the combination of text and image remained the same from the very earliest Akabon to the Gokan era. But the style, the amount of text and image changed radically over the years, and the style of the books, the content also changed radically. So where do monsters fit into all of this? Well, in the earliest books, in Akabon, the Kurobon, or in the Albon, what we monsters that had originated from legend or fairy tale type stories, they kept on the stereotype and were often depicted in a very stereotypical way. For example, they might be frightening creatures that would create havoc in the human world, and then there would be some valiant warrior whose job would be to confront these monsters and to slay them. And these warriors would often be someone that people would have been familiar with from legend or from earlier literary works. But at the same time, we can see an emergence of a new type of monster in which the monsters are used to parody stories from famous literary theatrical works. So they look like monsters, but they're actually acting more like humans than monsters. And this comical aspect is further developed when we reach the Kibyoshi stories. What I said earlier, these are the works that I'm most taken by. And even though these stories are meant for more of an adult audience than the earlier works were, these monster stories kept on being written. And but what changed is that the monsters started imitating the ways of the Edo sophisticate and even and tried to be fashionable and up to date, and yet they still kept on with their monster lifestyles and values. And this is where the humor comes in. I think of this humor as very similar to what we would find in the Addams Family comic strip. Monsters lifestyle are monster-like, but they're also like doing things that humans would do. This kind of contrast is very easy to understand, kind of universal humor. But this only lasted during the Kibyoshi genre. And when we move on to what we call the Gokan genre, these humorous monsters became replaced with kind of scary ghosts or frightening creatures that were conjured up by wizards. So we have a kind of cycle of monster stories within the Kusazoshi genre. To sum it up, first we have scary monsters that are in traditional conflict with humans, and these are gradually replaced by stories in which monsters become more comical as they try to imitate the ways of humans. And then finally, we return to an even more grotesque version with the Gokan, even more scary looking, revenge-seeking monsters or blood-dripping ghosts. But personally, I find the humorous monsters in Kibyoshi the most interesting. And I think this is because they have the most complex layers of meaning. So there's a lot to dig underneath with. There's a lot of, they're not just monsters for monsters' sake. Now, to talk about why I actually chose these works to translate. I mentioned that I've written two books in Japanese in 1999 and 2000. I took the five stories for this book from those two volumes, but there are 10 stories from the two volumes, so I had to cut the number in half. My first thought here was whether or not the stories would come across well in English. I wanted to pick works in which the narrative could be easily understood, even without referring to footnotes or to commentaries. And secondly, I also wanted to give the reader as much variety as possible. So I want to have a good selection of different types of stories here. So for the first story in the book, I chose a monster catalog, thinking this would be the best work to serve as a general introduction. This work is technically classified as a Kibyoshi, but there's actually very little text here, just a few lines describing the monsters illustrated on each page. So the value of the work is basically in the impact of the monster illustrations, but I also use the work as a way to guide the reader into the commentaries, which give detailed explanations of the cultural context for each of the monsters. So in a way, I use the first translation as a springing board for a general introduction into the monster world. And the next two stories, The Monsters to the Rescue and The Monster Takes a Bride, these are both written by Jinpachi Ikku, who was a master of these monster-themed Kibyoshi. In Monsters to the Rescue, we have a kind of reinvention of the typical monster slayer story. Here, the focus is on the monsters themselves, whose comical mishaps are the cause of their own downfall. And The Monster Takes a Bride is a retelling of the stages of the marriage ritual in the context of the monster world. This story is the best example, I think, of the Addams Family's type style humor I mentioned earlier, where monster values are superimposed over human lifestyle. So I think the humor here is in both universal and timeless. For example, where the prospective groom demands that the matchmaker find him the ugliest bride possible. This kind of humor would make sense in any cultural context. On the other hand, the story gives us very specific details on what the marriage process was like in the late Edo period Japan. So for much of the research I had to do for the commentary here had nothing to do with monsters per se, but that was involved with looking to the marriage customs of the time. So there's this kind of duality, a very detailed, accurate portrait of marriage customs and a very kind of universal humor of monsters reenacting marriage customs, but with a mindset that's very similar to what you would see basically anywhere else. And then we have the final two tales in the book, The River Imp and The Stinky Jewel, and The Demon Girl Comes to Edo. And here I shifted the focus to one particular monster type. In the case of the River Imp, I was looking at the Tokapa, what I talked about earlier, and with the demon girl to a modern prototype of demons or oni. This will bring us into a discussion of the intertextuality or the use of various media that we talked about earlier. The demon girl was based on oni or demon lore, which oni are sort of cousins to yokai or monsters, but they're very deeply rooted in folklore literature. So there was a very common background to the story that anyone reader of the day would have instantly picked up on. And yet the story was set in a very specific time and dealing with a very specific freak show or sideshow attraction that was based on this oni legend and prototype. So we have something very old and something very, very new mixed together to make an entirely new product in this story. Anyway, once I had chosen these five works to translate, and I thought in the order I wanted to present them in, I had to think about how to structure the book. And this was particularly challenging for me, especially what to do about the layout, as I'm sure all the readers have noticed, somewhat unusual way to present a translation. There actually aren't a lot of translations available in English about of Kusazoshi, but from what I can tell, the most common methods for layout are, well, the first one is to reduce the size of the image so it's small enough that the image and translation can appear on the same page, or this is a more recent method of translation, but you take out the cursive script inside the image. As I mentioned earlier, these kusazoshi, I wish I could show you one, but I can't, are there's text and image and a woodblock print together in very in filling up the entire page. And it seemed to me when you took out the Japanese text and put in the English, it was very jarring to me in a kind of aesthetic sense and also in terms of just how you read the book. I mean, one way of thinking is, well, this replicates reading a comic book or a manga more accurately, but it also presents difficult problems in how you where you put the English and then what you do with things like footnotes and additional information. So for me personally, I didn't think any either of these two layout examples would really work for this book. So one thing I thought that because of the strong image appeal of the monsters, I really needed to reproduce the images in full size. I couldn't have them as like little postage stamps stuck in among the translation. And also there's a lot, besides the monsters themselves, there's a lot of detail that you would miss inside the illustration. So they had to be big enough that you could catch that as well. But on the other hand, I felt that removing the Japanese script and substituting English text would have been too corrupting to the original books. So I decided to reproduce the images in full size and then have the translations follow the images. But in the case of two-page spread scenes, this would mean that the translation would have to appear on the following page, which certainly isn't ideal, but it seemed a better choice than to reduce the size of the images themselves. And the other major problem I had concerning the layout was what to do with the placement of the commentaries. I wanted to give a detailed commentary for each of the scenes, explaining what's going on in the illustrations, what you might miss if you didn't look carefully at them, and also to explain the cultural and historical references that really make these books so amazing to me. But the problem here is where to place the commentaries. Now, if I bunch them all together at the end of each story, the reader would have trouble aligning the commentary to which scene it belonged to. And I can even see the reader just saying, well, I don't need to read this, and just sort of skipping it over altogether. But for me, I saw the commentaries as an integral part of the translation, not as something subsidiary. So I decided in the end that the best solution is for the commentary to immediately follow the translation for each scene. In other words, the structure of the book is first we have the original Kusazoshi image, and this would be either a one-page scene or a two-page spread scene. This would be followed by a translation of the image, and this would be followed by the commentary, and then I would repeat this until the end of the story. And of course, I realized that by doing this, I was breaking up the translation with a lengthy commentary for each scene, which would disrupt the flow of the stories. But I really did give this a lot of thought. It still seemed to me the best alternative. One solution that the book designer came up with was to change the typeface for the translations and commentaries, so it would be easier for the reader to skip the commentaries completely if that's really what they wanted to do. And also, I try to make translations coherent in and of themselves if that's all you wanted to look at. In other words, I wanted to make the translations make sense even without the benefit of the commentaries and endnotes. That said, I hope the book will be read as a whole. And to help with the flow between translation and commentary, I made sure to start each commentary with an explanation of what's going on in the image. So I think of this as kind of a translation of the image. We think of translations as always referring to words, but you can translate images as well. And this is really important in Kibyoushi because, this is a medium where words and images have equal, to me at least, value. So you're not getting the full picture. Literally, if you're not saying what's going on in the picture. So I started the commentary as more of a translation of a picture to go along with the translation that preceded of the text. And then I present a lot more information. But in the end of the commentary, whenever possible, I try to draw the reader back to the original story. So there is at least not too much of a disruption of the flow here. Some of the reviewers of my book have pointed out that lengthwise, these commentaries are far longer than the translations themselves. And so, in many ways, I think of this book as a monograph that's massing itself as a translation, which is, I hope people can enjoy the translations as translations, but I hope people can also enjoy all the information I'm trying to provide that goes along
Well,
with it.
yeah, and I think that's a sort of problem of the genre of the annotated translation, right? Especially with something as rich as what you're working with, is that the annotations are necessarily going to be lengthy. And in addition, as you say, you have both the text and the image to actually translate and to comment on. Plus, there's all this information that not just a modern reader would want, but that the original intended audience would have brought to this. There's so many layers that you're kind of trying to put together here. I admit that the sort of layout choice is a little bit, it's unusual. It's an unusual reading experience, but I think, as you've explained, it's probably the best choice given what you're working with.
Thank you for saying that. To be perfectly honest, still, even as the book was coming out, I was, oh my God, is this going to be readable to anybody? Is it completely incoherent? Because I had no reference of something that was like this. On the other hand, I didn't want to put all this information to footnotes or endnotes that people would, tiny little print that people aren't going to look at. And so I tried to make the commentaries readable, and I tried to sift explanations of complicated word plays and allusions into endnotes that you didn't necessarily need, but you should have if you want to look further into the scholarly intent of the book. But the real information, what you just said about what the readers of the time would might know and what you really needed to know to understand the story, I just felt they had to go into the main body somehow. And so this is what I came up with. By the way, with all these images and all this challenging layout problems, this was really a difficult book to assemble, and I would like to take the opportunity here to thank the editors and especially the book designer, Columbia University Press, because they really put in the extra mile of making this all come together somehow and staying true to the way I try envisioned the book in its early stages.
Great. So I want to actually take a moment to look at the final two stories in the book. You've already told us that's number four is The River Imp and The Stinky Jewel, which is the eponymous title story, and then there's The Demon Girl Comes to Edo. And I want to sort of think about the contrast between the two of them, right? In the same genre of Kibyoshi, they're kind of doing different things. So first, let's talk about The River Imp and The Stinky Jewel. So I want to talk about, as I said, the River Imp and The Stinky Jewel. I think this eponymous story, on the one hand, sort of represents the sophistication of the stories, the sort of wink, wink, parodic referentiality of the Kibyoshi genre on the one hand, but it also has what I think a modern audience would see as essentially crude sexual humor and cheap laughs. And I think this is a really interesting internal contrast for at least the modern audience. But I wanted to ask you, is that apparent mix of crassness and sophistication, would the original audience have seen it that way, or is this something that we as a modern audience are imposing upon it?
You bring up an interesting point here about the original audience. And when you're dealing with pre-modern literary texts, this is extremely important, but also extremely difficult to pin down. We have virtually no written accounts of what the average reader of the time might have thought of these books. There is one famous critique that's often cited by the writer Ota Nampo, who rated Kibyoshi as if he was writing reviews for Amazon. One of the works he praised is a story in which a monster couple gives birth to a human child who ends up becoming the victim of all sorts of discrimination in the monster world. And I thought this story works really well as a kind of social commentary by reversing the values of monsters and humans. But what Ota Nampo liked about the work were these obscure literary references, none of which were particularly interesting or funny to me. So I'm thinking that Kibyoshi were enjoyed in different ways by different readers. For example, children might have just enjoyed looking at the illustrations. And adults from the middle class might have enjoyed the narratives and the crass sexual innuendos, which wouldn't have been considered at all taboo in the way they might be considered today, and or the lowbrow humor, the bathroom humor of the stories. And they might not have catched all the literary allusions, but what I just mentioned about Ota Nampo's critique, for the intellectuals or very highly educated samurai, it might have been these allusions that were the most interesting for them. So I can see parallels with animated films that are basically targeting children, but which also include references and sometimes off-color jokes that only adults would get. So I think there are very many different layers to understanding back then and even now, and they can operate separately or they could operate together. One measure of audience reaction is looking at how well the book sold. And although stories centering on monsters are only a small part of the entire body of Kibyoshi, they were consistently published year after year. I've sort of tracked down every one of these stories, and there isn't, I think there was one year when there wasn't any of these, but basically, they were published by different publishers and different writers pretty consistently year after year. So that makes me think that there was a steady re readership for these kind of stories. And publishers wouldn't keep putting them out if they didn't think they had a market for them. Now, to go back to what it is about the River Rip and the Stinky Jewel that attracted me to the story in the first place. Well, as I mentioned earlier, my interest in Kibyoshi began with trying to figure out what the literary roots of the kappa was. And this was one of the very first stories that I read, where a kappa plays a very essential role. So, oh wow! So they were really into kappa all the way back then, several hundred years ago. Then the other thing that struck me as so fascinating about the story is that the plot is all about what I translate as buttocks jewel, or shirikodama in Japanese, which this is refers to an imaginary jewel that the kappa covets and that he can extract by reaching his hand inside a human's anus. And this is about the extent of the Shirikodama legend. So what first struck me as really unusual about the story was how the author, Jinpachi Ikku, created this totally original and really coherent comic narrative out of basically this buttocks jewel legend. By the way, in my book, In the translation I have for Monster Catalog, there's also a scene where a couple pulls the human into the river and then reaches inside to extract his organs. But this scene is frightening, it's grotesque, it's not at all comical. Whereas Iku's story is played purely for laughs. And so this is a very contrasting image of Kappa. I mean, I believe that there would have been people who would have been sincerely afraid of Kappa back then. Even nowadays, I occasionally meet Japanese who find Kappa frightening. I have a funny story about when I was a student, and I found this what I thought was a cute little Kappa object, and I gave it to a friend of mine, and she said, "I don't want it. That's scary. Take it away." Oh no! It sort of shocked me that somebody actually found these things scary. But so I think the people who would have been scared, the people who thought the Kappa really did exist, but then obviously there were people who saw this purely as literary fiction, and the way Iku plays the Kappa for laughs would have been the way that the readers would have accepted the Kappa in their interpretation or reading of it. And again, the toilet humor that's so pervasive in this story, well, it's not everyone's cup of tea, but it's certainly universal. And suddenly I feel, well, this is going to like translate into English. People will get this, right? So that was one of the things that attracted me to the story, made me think that this would be a good choice to translate. And not to get back to what you were talking about crassness mixing sophistication and how these whether the distinction is really valid or not for the readers of the time. Well, it sort of depends on what we think of as sophisticated and how much if we think of sophistication as meaning something that's very erudite or obscure, then we have to think about how much would the readers of the day have really understood or not understood to pair compared to what, for example, what a modern Japanese speaking audience would understand, or what a modern audience who doesn't speak Japanese and is reading a translation would understand. So, for example, the story involves a historical figure tied in a masakado, and then the association of kappa with flatulence and with sexuality. And I think that these associations needs a kind of explanation today, but would have been self-evident to the readers of the time. On the other hand, there are parodies that would have been maybe missed by some of the readers. For example, there's a scene in which Kamatado, the hero whose buttock jewel is stolen by the kappa, and it's replaced with the kappa's fart jewel, which is and then he can't stop farting, and then he ends up becoming part of a fart show where his farts are used to make money. And this is an actual parody of a sideshow attraction that occurred 24 years earlier, where the so-called fart man would be able to fart in time to music and fart out songs and do all sorts of kind of tricks like that. But this is 24 years later, so you have to wonder how much this connection would have been felt by the readers. And yet you see references to the fart man sideshow pop up frequently in popular literature. So I'm actually thinking that it was still known in one form or another, even after these 24 years. The problem with doing edo literature is that you really have to read a lot of it to see what's very common and what is not so common. If you read over a wide sort of wide field of including a lot of different genres, you can see, oh, this is coming up here, this is coming up here. This is something that was popular, was probably well known by the readers of the day. And then that makes it more clear when it's something that is really was obscure. Some of the literary references I would think only the intellectuals of the day would have known. And we have to remember that the people who were writing these stories were not illiterate people, were very even someone like Gepeshi Iku, who is not from the samurai class, would have known a lot, was very widely read. But on the other hand, he was writing to make his works popular. So if you make something too obscure, too hard to understand, you're going to lose your basic audience. So it's a balancing act, right, of making the works both Interesting enough to satisfy this kind of audience like Otonampo, who would want something that had a little more meat on it, perhaps, or sophistication, and also an audience who just wanted the crass humor, and then they were fine with that. One scene that is would need an explanation for the modern day reader, but is probably pretty understandable to the reader of the day, was the scene where Kamatato asked a girl to dive into the river and retrieve his buttocks jewel that had been stolen by the kappa. And this scene parodies, well, it starts out as a very, very famous legend about a diving girl that retrieves a precious jewel that had been stolen by the dragon king who lives in the sea, and she ends up dying in the attempt. And this is a legend, but it appears in no plays and in other forms of theatrical arts, and comes up over and over again in ukiyo-e prints, and also in kibyoushi, it comes up a lot in parody forms. So I'm thinking this was something that the writers really drew upon when, they didn't like go out of their way to find something obscure that no one would know about, or at least not all the time. And by the same token, this is something that the readers of the day probably would have known. So ultimately, I think this issue of sophistication in kibyoushi comes down to the stance of the reader. In other words, what is it that you're finding interesting in the work? How are you engaging with it? So you could read the River Imp just for its illustrations, or as a tale about a mythical river creature, or as a comedy of errors involving a mix-up between a buttocks jewel or a sacred fart jewel, or something that's very meta where the writer is actually looking at his own work and saying, well, is this really stupid, or this doesn't make much sense, but hey, it's kind of funny. Or you could read it as a complicated parody full of all sorts of references and literary allusions, or even as a social commentary, on the customs of the day. And so I think that this fluidity is one of the things that is really the most appealing about kibyoushi. And I hope that the readers in English can find different ways to engage in this work. I'm thinking if it's being used in a college course, it would be read one way. If it's someone who's just interested in manga and anime and wants to read a funny story, it could be read that way as well. So that's what, at least what I was aiming for with this book.
Yes, and so we're going to talk about the last story as well, which is the Demon Girl Comes to Edo. And I wanted to talk about this one because it does some very different things and does them in some different ways. So the Demon Girl Comes to Edo, it doesn't really have the body humor of the Stinky Jewel. It doesn't, there's, I don't have any questions about crassness and about, that sort of thing. But it does this very interesting thing, which is it mixes up two different kinds of advertisement, right? There's advertisement for a sideshow on the one hand, which I guess may be crass, I don't know. And then there's sort of pious advertisement for the Zenkoji Buddha, Buddhism writ large of the time. But of course, there's the association between Zenkoji and the sideshow itself, which obviously makes that distinction a sort of, maybe an artificial one. The thing that impressed me about the story itself was the degree to which it's very much an appeal to the ego of the audience, the Edo middle class. So compared to them, even demons are just laughable bumpkins, unable to follow this web of interreferentiality that makes up these stories. And I kind of felt that, there's that feeling as the reader of enjoying, I get this, I understand this. Somebody else is not going to get it. Somebody else is not going to understand it. So I sort of felt like there's a competitive reading aspect to all of these stories, but this is one where it plays out actually in the story with the monsters. And so can you tell us about the Demon Girl Comes to Edo and about the way that it's enmeshed in Edo society?
Yeah, you brought up some very good points there about how this work is actually somewhat different than the four other works that I translated. And one of the reasons is that was a particular kind of kibyoushi called a kiwamono, which refers to something that's published in connection with some other event or that's going on at the time. In this case, it was a Zenkoji Buddha tract. Action, if you want to call it that. It was being shown at a temple, the Ukiyo-e Temple in Edo, for just 1 month. So this was attracting a lot of people to the area. And kibyoushi were generally published in the new year. They weren't published all year round. So people would buy them as New Year's gifts, for example. But in the case of kiwamono, it didn't make sense. if you didn't publish them in to go along with whatever event that you were talking about in the Kiwamono. So these were this particular story, the story of the Demon Girl, was published to coincide with showing of the Zenkoji Buddha. So the whole publication aspect changes here. It's meant to be for a specific audience, at least initially. People who would have seen the actual attraction, or people who wanted to see it, I'm sure, or people who couldn't see it, but wanted to heard about it and wanted to read the book about it. In any case, the story has a very definite time and place. None of the other stories have that. We can set this story to the summer of 1778, to the Eikoin Temple in Edo, and to all these things that were happening around it. For example, one of the most interesting things in the story was that when to publicize this freak show where this woman was put rushing to see her, and to actually publicize the event, they produce this fake holiday of Setsubun, which is normally held after the new year, not in the summer. But and this is something that's recorded in diaries and journals from people at the time, so we know that it really occurred. And people would throw beans and pretend it was that day when it really wasn't. And in a way, it was kind of advertising the show. So this was also a scene that appears in the Kibyoshi. This is very meta here, right? This is they're depicting things that were really going on at the time, and the book was published at the time that the show was actually on. And yet, would this be at all understandable to people who weren't, for example, people who didn't live in Edo or didn't know about the thing? So there is a certain what did you how did you put it exactly? The Edo middle class, or the Edo I, the person, people living in actually living in this city, looking down at the people who may have come from the countryside or didn't know that much about Edo customs. That's evident in this story, and in the way that Demon Girl is portrayed as a kind of country bumpkin who doesn't really know what's going on and keeps making these mistakes after mistakes. So in that sense, it's a very much work that's attached to a time and to a place, but it's also has a kind of continuity with the other stories, that the Demon Girl is kind of like these bumbling country bumpkin monsters who doesn't know her way around and is ending up, being very clueless about what's going on in the city. So if you look at it, and this, interestingly enough, the publication date for the Demon Girl Comes to Edo coincides with when these stories about monsters coming to Edo and not really understanding the culture there, and then going back to their countryside at the end of the story. They're basically coinciding. So I think there was a, if you look at the Demon Girl within the context of monsters in general, you could see this story within a sort of pattern that was popular at that time. Okay, so what does this say about how Edo people looked at people from not just monsters, but just people in general who are not from their same milieu or from the same background? Well, one point that we have to keep in mind is that this kind of superiority complex on the part of the Edoite was, in a way, an overcompensation for their sense of inferiority toward the older, more aristocratic culture of Kyoto. So, Edo was a newer culture, and they thought they were better than everybody else. But on one part, they actually did think, well, maybe we're not as good as people, or we don't have this rich history, we don't have this sort of elegant culture. So they were sort of overcompensating for it in this not just in the story, but in their general bravado about feeling that, what we're doing is really new and exciting and much more interesting than what's going on in the rest of Japan. And then on a personal note, though, well, I can't help feeling a certain kind of affinity with the demon girl and with the monsters themselves who aren't accepted to Edo society. And this is something I can't really answer, but I wonder if the Edo audience had this kind of ambivalent attitude toward the demon girl. On the one hand, they might have been looking down at her, but maybe they also felt an affinity for her predicament, or that, she really was having so much trouble getting around and doing things, and this was not simply a way of making fun of her, but also a kind of way of finding kind of empathy with the underdog. When we think of monsters and demons and people like the Kappa, the Oni Musume, these are non-human creatures that should be inherently scary, but these stories turn them into like weak or bumbling or naive, and I think it lends to them a kind of charm. It's entirely possible that, assuming that there's some kind of affinity with monsters and outcasts, maybe giving a much too modern interpretation of these stories. So this is something that you really, again, without a lot of information on how ac readers reacted to these stories, is sort of hard to pin down. But I do think they certainly did see them purely as objects to look down at or scorn. Remember that a lot of kibyoshi are making fun of the opposite extreme of the Edo sophisticate who goes to great extremes to show just how sophisticated they are when they really aren't that sophisticated. So there was a lot of there were parodies of Country Bumpkins, but there were also parodies of the archetype of the know-it-all who was very world wise and able to get around in Yoshiwara and in the city, but really at their heart were just sort of very pompous and full of themselves. So this is something that certainly you can think about and interpret in different ways. But at the end of the day, I think The Demon Girl Comes to Edo is basically a very clever promotional tie-in. And this is what's so fascinating, what you brought up earlier, this combination of religious worship with popular entertainment, and how books and freak shows and publicity events like the Setsubun or bean throwing event were used to produce, a commercial product that went over various media and that could appeal to a popular audience, not just a very limited audience. I mean, I'm not sure if The Demon Girl Comes to Edo was actually widely read or widely distributed, but the Demon Girl itself kept appearing in literary works and kibyoshi and other works way after the freak show ended. So it's interesting how something that started for a limited audience and that was produced really for an Edo audience ended up becoming a more general character that was perceived or understood by a much wider audience, and who perhaps weren't even aware of the connection between this demon girl and the original sideshow, and just thought of it as a kind of funny character in the kibyoshi. So it's multifaceted, and there are definitely lots of different ways to interpret this work. I was hesitant whether I should include this in the book or not, but a lot of people have actually found that the most interesting of the stories. So that was actually surprising to me as the author.
Well, that is very interesting. I definitely enjoyed it a great deal, and sort of thinking about the commercial uses of the kibyoshi was sort of it was a nice way to end the book, right? Because it sort of it su suggested more possibilities out there. So thank you for taking us through this. And obviously, podcasting is not the most visual genre, so I'm going to encourage our listeners to also be readers and enjoy as you said, sort of the full-size reproductions of these, fascinating. It's almost a shame to call them texts because they are both texts and pictures in an integrated and fascinating way, and to also think about some of these issues of translation and presentation of these different genres and different times. Very much the past is a different country sort of feeling in reading this and trying to sort of put myself in the position of the original intended audience, of course. And I had a it was a fun puzzle, and it sounded like it was the same for you. And thank you for doing it. And hopefully we'll get a chance to have you back on for I know you have a stockpile of Kibyoshi and other works that you've worked with. So maybe we'll get you back on here for talking about some more of those in the future.
Well, thank you very much. This was a great opportunity to talk about this book. I really appreciate it.